Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and I have a very special guest today, Dennis Paulson. Dennis is an icon naturalist and biologist in the Pacific Northwest. He's a professor at the University of Puget Sound, and where he was also, until I think his retirement, congratulations, Dennis, of the Slater Museum of Natural History. He's a worldwide traveler, quite an amazing photographer, and an author of a number of really wonderful natural history books. And what we'll be doing today is exploring some of Dennis's reflections over his long years of birding and natural historizing. I think I just made up that word, in the Puget Sound region. Welcome, Dennis. Glad you're here.
I'm glad I'm here as well. Nice to talk to you.
Well, and also I do need to confess that Dennis is the lead author of one of my favorite bird guides. It's the Birds of the Puget Sound Region, and it's the updated version.
Uh-huh.
It's a wonderful sort of pocket-sized, it's a photographic guide. I like it, too, because it meets the needs of beginning birders as well as the more experienced ones. And it is small enough to keep on the windowsill in my living room, along with a pair of binoculars.
Good. That's certainly the purpose of
that's
it.
That's right. It is so accessible.
I'll tell Bob and Christina Morris you said that.
Okay. And for listeners, Dr. Paulson will be the lead speaker at the Friends of Fort Warden 30th birthday party on Friday, April the 14th at the Fort Warden Commons. And I'll share more information on this event towards the end of this program. And as usual, before we go on and talk about the Birds of Puget Sound and the Olympic Peninsula, let's hear this week's mystery sound. So a bit of a hint, if this wasn't immediately obvious to you, the bird that makes the sound is very numerous and very widespread. Many of them actually stay here in our area year-round. Others come to breed, and still others pass through during migrations. Just open your car window as you drive around town, or better yet, go out for a walk, especially in the early spring, and you will hear this bird clearly announcing its presence. It's special to me, too, because it is one of the very first birds I learned to identify by ear, which has always been a challenge for me to do. So it was like, yes, I got this one. So now to Dennis, you know, explore your long involvement here in this area. And I realize it's been a long time, but how long have you been in the sort of Puget Sound, Pacific Northwest area?
I actually was living in North Carolina. I actually lived in Florida much of my early life in Miami. So this is a very different place to be.
Really?
A professor at the University of Washington, Gordon Oriens, who is recognized in his own right for contributing a tremendous amount to ornithology, contacted me and said he needed someone who knew about dragonflies because he was studying red-winged blackbirds and he was going to spend 14 months in Costa Rica studying red-winged blackbirds at their southernmost extent of their range in northwestern Costa Rica. And they eat largely dragonflies in this area, so he wanted an insect person to come down there with him and study the dragonflies while he was studying the blackbirds. And we could do it together, and it was great. And so we went down there. It turned out that the red wings in Costa Rica weren't eating dragonflies. They were eating grasshoppers, but that's okay. We still were able to study them. June 1966 to August 1967, I worked in Costa Rica with Gordon and had a wonderful time there. Learned all about tropical biology while I was there because we had plenty of free time besides our studies to wander around the country and learn things. And then after that was over, then I came back to the University of Washington with Gordon and had the same postdoc for a year at UW from fall of 1967 to the spring to the summer of 1968. And then I was doing some other things. And then I actually got hired on the faculty of the University of Washington as an assistant professor, taught there for 5.5 years, I guess. Didn't get tenure, sadly, but I went on to do other things. So I actually worked for a firm of architects and landscape architects for 15 years doing zoo design and interpretive work and master plans for green spaces and parks and reserves and aquaria, just a whole bunch of different things. And then I did a lot of other things. I wrote books and I led nature tours and et cetera during that period as well, traveled a lot. And then I got hired at the University of Puget Sound to be the director of the Slater Museum of Natural History and to teach there. And I was there for 15 years and I actually retired in 2004. So I've retirement life. As I tell people, I'm working harder and making less money now. That's retirement.
I find that true, but having a lot of fun.
Yes, exactly. Doing what you totally what you want to do. And it's really, it is great. But I still actually go down and work one day a week at the Slater Museum after being retired for so long. So I've kept that up and it's very enjoyable to me. And I've been a birder since age 12. I got my first bird book at age 12 when I lived in Miami and started my life list and just sort of went on from there. It wasn't until after I got up here, which was a couple of years after I got my PhD degree, that I started writing books. And my first book was Shorebirds of the Pacific Northwest, which I think still is the one I'm proudest of, and went on to study birds and dragonflies for sort of the rest of my life so far and write books and papers about them. Been very interested in seabirds. Again, I didn't ever in a million years think I would end up in Seattle, Washington, because my whole history was in sort of the East and the Southeast. But here I am. And I've loved being here. And anyway, the seabirds, of course, caught my eye very soon because we're right on Puget Sound here. And it's very easy to travel to the outer coast and the San Juans and just all around. So I think that's probably why I wrote the book on shorebirds, because shorebirds are such an important feature, sandpipers and plovers, important feature of this region.
Yeah, and I won't give a spoiler, but that is the topic of your talk with the Friends of Fort Worden.
It was on seabirds.
On seabirds, yeah.
And the seabirds are not the shorebirds. They're the birds that we see out on the water, perched on the water and swimming and diving, like loons and grebes and guillemots and gulls and those sorts of birds. And that's what I'll be talking about at the Friends of Fort Worden.
So thinking more reflectively, I think I heard once there's like maybe 260 or so species of bird in our regions. You will correct me if that's not the right number, but I think that's what I remember. Can you share with our listeners a story of a very special or favorite experience you had while birding around here? Just pick just one, of course, you know.
That's a really hard one. And I guess I should say that some of my nicest experiences have been seeing a bird in my own yard that I didn't expect.
Isn't that true?
I keep a yard list. I think we've lived where we live now for a little over 30 years, and I think I've seen and heard 115 species of birds here right in the city of Seattle. We live above a ravine, so there's a lot of greenery, and a lot of the birds just come through. And I've watched hawks migrating over in the fall. And I know I'm not answering your question.
No, but it also sort of points to the what can we see just from our own home environment.
It does indeed. And it's just, there's just so much. I mean, there's just an infinite number of wonderful experiences I've had. Some of them finding rare birds myself, like finding a Eurasian dotterel out at Ocean Shores many years ago.
I don't even know what that is, but okay.
Weekly censuses of all birds at Ocean at Grays Harbor for a little over a year in 1981. And I would drive down there once a week, usually getting some friend to come with me and spend the day basically just visiting all the areas around Grays Harbor and looking at the shorebirds, doing some photography of them, counting them, and coming back and recording them in my notes.
I'm a little familiar with Bowerman Basin from that era.
That's right.
And the amazing shorebird populations there.
That's right. And I was down there with Steve Herman occasionally. He was the one who really publicized it and essentially got it turned into a wildlife refuge there. So that was a great thing. I can't really talk about birds very long without talking about their decline, which is a really sad thing about birds in nature. The species that are common are those that have adapted to humans. And the species that haven't adapted to humans, like crows and some kinds of gulls and the birds in our yards, like juncos and robins and flickers, mostly are on the decline. And that's been publicized well enough by various societies. It's really true of water birds and of some kinds of water birds, not all of them. Here, I've been in Seattle for, I guess, 55 years now. And I have seen that so vividly. And because I contributed my bird records from Grays Harbor to eBird, which is a platform that so many birders use now. And it's a wonderful database with millions and millions of records of birds now. And I contributed all that stuff to there maybe, you know, 20 or 30, well, 40 years possibly, after I actually was doing the censusing at Ocean Shores. And so many of my counts were questioned by the vet, by the eBird vetters. This count is too large.
It and can't I said, be.
No,
yeah.
That's in fact how common they were back 30 years ago. And that was that really pointed out to me that these people were saying, no, there you couldn't have seen 1,000 of Western sandpipers on that day at Grays Harbor because there aren't that many. Well, there were back in the 1980s.
You know, that's interesting that because not long ago I was in a conversation with some naturalist friends here in the area, and we were talking about the Klamath Basin in Oregon and whether it still had the huge populations that it used to have, especially in the migrating birds. And there were folks saying, well, they had been there recently and saw lots and lots of birds, so had it really gone down? And the point I was trying to make is we probably don't know.
An element of that, because we didn't have good censuses back 50 and 100 years ago, and eBird is helping that. And Christmas bird counts and breeding bird surveys have been the main source of information about bird populations and their stability, increase and or decline. And as I say, some birds are doing very, very well. Some birds that are pretty fancy, like snow geese, which are increasing all the time because they are a bird that's adapted to people. They eat crops, which, of course, people up in Skagit County don't like very much. So there's a certain amount of conflict about that. But again, birds like that, mallards, are very successful because we actually manage for ducks because ducks are hunted. Ducks are hunted, so they have a big lobby. And so ducks and geese both, so they're managed.
Actually, I want to take you back to your home birdwatching station and tell me the oddest bird you've ever seen there. Or the most surprising?
The most surprising, I guess, was a northern water thrush one day in spring migration. This is a species that's common in the east, and it breeds all across Canada, even into eastern Alaska. In Washington, it's just a very small population of breeders in the northeast corner of the state. And we also get small numbers of migrants in the western part of the state, even a few winter in Skagit County around Wiley Slough. They've been seeing a number of winters. But still, it's a very rare bird generally in western Washington. So seeing one of those walking around the backyard that I managed to get a photo of was pretty exciting. Many other birds, like a calliope hummingbird, a dusky flycatcher.
Those I think of being very exotic to this area.
Yeah, exactly. So this, if you have a particular patch, like my yard in this case, that you're seeing day after day, week after week, month after year, it's really interesting to see both what you can see and then the changes that take place over time. And the changes have been just dramatic. When we moved here in 1991, there were swallows overhead all day, every day in the summer. I haven't seen a swallow. The last swallows we saw were about 5 years after we moved here.
I want to ask about the swallows, because I too have actually noticed that around our house. Now, I don't keep a list, which is a failure of my personality, I guess. So it's an empirical observation. I used to see a lot of violet greens, but I haven't seen many. So what's going on with the swallows?
There's two things that I think both of which are playing a part. One is the decline of nest sites. As we tidy up our cities, we get rid of little crevices and things that some of these birds nest in. That could be significant in the decline of birds such as house sparrows and starlings, for example. The swallows are not like house sparrows and starlings. They're aerial insect eaters. I think it may be that the decline of insects probably plays an even bigger part in
that. Of course.
But violet green swallows are still pretty common out in the countryside, but they've just disappeared from Seattle almost completely. I used to see them anywhere I went, anywhere I drove around Seattle in the summer. Now, absolutely not a one. Same, pretty much the same with barn swallows. Those are the two city swallows. Mm-hmm. It may be mostly the decline of insects.
And that sort of makes, I guess, some sense about in terms of tidying up the urban environment as well as the number of chemicals that get sprayed immediately into the air around the area.
Well, we pretty well know about the so-called insect apocalypse, and it seems to have manifested itself very much so in flying insects. Mm-hmm. And so all those things that eat flying insects are probably declining, all those birds. Birds of this area and maybe everywhere can be described probably in three words: abundant, diverse, you know, there's probably 10,000 species of birds in the world, and declining.
And declining.
The third word is the bad one.
That's the sad word.
It's the sad, and it's totally because there's too many of us. between agriculture, which we have to feed ourselves, and development, which we have to house ourselves, we're forcing the other creatures out of the world. I've taught a lot of bird classes, and I don't start every lecture with, oh, woe is me, the world is going to hell. It's true. The positive part of it is that most of those species are still with us. Most of them you can still go out and see. There are lots of wild areas. There are lots of large areas preserved in parks and reserves. So we're still in a very good place. But there are some like tipping points, I think. Mm-hmm. And of course, climate change is one of the main ones that we're talking about now.
Yeah, I want to ask you about your thoughts on the climate change and the effects you might have noticed so far, and then what you think about for the future in terms of the effect on birds and our natural systems.
Sure. Well, climate change is, you know, is known to have a variety of effects, one of which is to create drought. And so drought kills off fish and amphibians, mm-hmm. and makes places that water birds can't breed anymore. And all the insects that they ate when they did breed there aren't there anymore. So that's one of the things. Warming temperatures affect the ocean probably more significantly than the land even. And so that's caused things like the offshore blob we've had off the mm-hmm. coast. That proved to be just terrible for seabirds in general, just killing off so much of what they ate, apparently.
And that was the time that we saw the big common muir die off. Is that right?
And Cassin's auklets were the ones that really, really died. The common murres did as well, and a variety of other birds, yes. So that's a problem. And other than that, climate change has done minor things like probably taken out of synchrony the emergence of insects and the blooming of plants and when birds arrive in their migration, things like those are pretty small things yet that we don't seem to think there's too much of a problem with that. That I would say effects on birds have been much more severe in the ocean than on land, it seems to me. I don't think climate change has changed very much about our land birds, but I think that decline of insects has been a very, very important part, because those are the birds that have declined so much are the insect eaters. The seed eaters, the sparrows and the blackbirds and things like that are doing much better.
So I'm thinking about resiliency of species. And you've mentioned, of course, those that can adapt to human presence and development, those who are not dependent on sensitive food sources like insects. What are some other components that may make one species more resilient than another?
Well, a breadth of diet, certainly. The ability to eat a wide variety.
So diversity, yeah.
Plenty of birds that eat both seeds and insects, for example. Raptors, a lot of raptors are actually doing surprisingly well, especially that we've got rid of much of the DDT in our environment mm-hmm. and stopped that major problem from happening. Quite a few of the birds that were really affected by DDT, like eagles and ospreys and brown pelicans, all are rebounding, which is a wonderful thing. So there's really some very good news at the same time as bad news. When I came to Washington, there were no brown pelicans. If you saw a brown pelican, that was a vagrant, that was a rarity. And I went out birding with Zella Schultz, who was a very famous birder in this area for a long time, to the coast probably back about 1968 or 69. And we saw a brown pelican, and she was just like freaking out, totally overjoyed about seeing this bird. Now you can go out to the mouth of the Columbia River and see 5,000 mm-hmm. brown pelicans in the summer.
Yeah, it's interesting because I remember when I first came to the Puget Sound area, I had spent a couple of years in California and moved up here and was noticing there are no brown pelicans. And then I might see a small flock a decade later, and now there are brown pelicans.
Yeah, there's so many in the South Coast, the mouth of the Columbia River in Willapa Bay and Grace Harbor, that they're coming into Puget Sound more and more every year. There were a half a dozen of them that spent this summer at Edmonds, which was
interesting.
First.
So are they out-competing any of the sort of standard old-time residents? Or
I don't think so. I can't swear to that. I mean, I guess I think we don't really know. Mm. He certainly eats some of the same fish that, but they're here in the summer when we don't have the biggest population of. Well, I guess we have a lot of, I think they're eating different fish maybe than rhinoceros auklets are, larger fish. Actually, we just don't know
really
what brown pelicans are eating in Puget Sound. That's one thing we're not doing as many food studies on birds as we used to do. It's harder to tell what what birds are eating now. Then there was a long period where birds were collected and their stomach contents were examined. We had a really good database on what birds ate. Now that's not being done very much anymore, and so it's harder to know.
Do you think there's anything regionally really significant, especially fascinating, unique about this area, or do you think it's more all systems and how all the systems operate?
Well, I think in a general sense, it's like all systems operate, but we are blessed by having extremely productive waters in the Pacific Northwest.
Yes.
We have ocean currents and upwellings that combine to make incredible productivity in all levels of the food chain. And that has been manifested in the incredible abundance of marine birds and mammals in this area, certainly when I came here and you know, back in history. And many of them are still very abundant, but most of them have declined, at least in my experience. Whatever it is that's changing in the world is really affecting them severely. The numbers of birds in this region, we have a pretty substantial breeding population of seabirds, the rhinoceros auklets you mentioned, and guillemots and gulls and cormorants, and not too many species, but a fair number, and more as you get out to the outer coast with murres and Cassin's auklets and storm petrels. And then we have a lot of birds coming here in the winter, a lot of seabirds that are fish eating and mollusk eating and crab eating, from the Arctic, from the subarctic, from the boreal forest, from the prairies, from the interior, all over the interior, coming out to the North Pacific coast because there's a heck of a lot of stuff to eat in the ocean here. Then in addition to them, especially in the summer, we have birds like the brown pelicans and the Harriman's gulls coming up from California. Why don't they stay in California? Well, there's more to eat up here. So they migrate hundreds and hundreds of miles to get to the waters off Oregon and Washington and British Columbia.
That's really interesting that it's worth their time and effort and energy
exactly
to come this far because of the food.
Exactly. And then you have Southern Hemisphere birds like shearwaters and some petrels that come all the way up here. Well, sooty shearwaters from New Zealand and short-tailed shearwaters from Australia that come into the North Pacific because this is their, of course, it's their winter. They're coming all the way up here. Apparently where they live down there in the breeding season isn't that productive in the winter, in their winter, which is our summer. So they cross the equator and come all the way up here by some of them tens of thousands. And most of those birds are still doing fairly well. Some of them have declined, but there are still a lot of such birds out in the ocean. Fortunately, I mean, there's none that are so rare that, oh my God, I saw a rhinoceros auklet yesterday. What a thrill. You know,
I still say that when I see a rhinoceros auklet, they're amazing little birds.
Sure.
So, Dennis, I'm just fascinated by this sort of reflection conversation and thinking about the complexity of our bird world and thinking about the richness of the food source. I've been thinking about gray whales lately and why do they migrate and thinking about how important the oceanic food sources are to birds as well. It's really interesting.
Indeed.
So I do have a question I'm going to ask you on behalf of probably a bunch of listeners is, can you share one or two of your favorite birding locations?
Oh, sure. You mentioned on the Olympic Peninsula.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say the Everglades or Australia. Well,
no. But places we all can get to easily from where we are.
Well, I still like Admiralty Inlet from Point Hudson or Point Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not as many birds as there used to be, but sometimes there are a lot of birds there and they're really fun to watch. So often there are large numbers of birds migrating past literally out in the middle of Admiralty Inlet. So you really need a spotting scope to see them. But with a scope, you can get some good observations. And then some of them come closer as well. I like Fort Flagler State Park very much. That's always, we walk out to the end of the spit there and there's always something to see there. I like Dungeness very much.
Dungeness, yes.
Kayak there a lot. If you have a kayak, you can kayak all over Dungeness Bay and there's a lot of good things to see there. Farther out, I love Nea Bay. Nea Bay, of course, has been very popular with birders because of all the rarities that are found there. When there aren't rarities, it's still great for birds. There's just a lot of birds you see right in the bay itself. And you can drive out to the outer coast to the ocean at Hobuck Beach and places like that. And again, see many, many more seabirds. And not only seabirds, but as I say, a lot of the rarities that have turned up there are migrant land birds, little warblers from Kentucky and from Arizona and from Newfoundland and just an amazing
array. I had not realized that about the Niue Bay.
And from Japan,
area.
I mean, there's so many birds heading west in our state or heading north in our state come to the end of the road there. Yes. And they say when you're at Cape Flattery, they call it Cape Flattery because Flattery will lead you nowhere.
Okay. Well, and on that thought, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today. Thanks a bunch.
My pleasure, Nan.
Well, fascinating talking to Dennis Paulson. And I want to remind people that Dennis will be the lead speaker at the Friends of Fort Worden 30th birthday party, which is Friday evening, April the 14th at the Fort Worden's Commons. He'll be talking about primarily the seabirds of Admiralty Inlet. And you can learn more and register at the Friends of Fort Worden website. And as we near the end, of course, we have to hear that mystery sound again. That was the call of the white-crowned sparrow. When you first see the white-crowned sparrow, it could appear to be just sort of a plainish, brownish, grayish bird, a little bigger than a song sparrow. It's got a small bill and a long tail. But if you look again, that's the important part. Look again, because then you will see the striking and really bold black and white stripes on its head. And the head shape is odd, too. Sometimes it's distinctly peaked, kind of punkish. And other times it's smooth and flat. And the Cornell Ornithology website says that depends on the bird's attitude at the time. Well, with that, thank you for listening. And thanks to Dennis Paulson. Thanks to the Friends of Fort Worden. And thanks to our sound engineer, Nora Petrich. And let me remind you that Nature Now podcasts are available on the KPTZ website. Our ending music today is When My Sugar Walks Down the Street, All the Little Birdies Go Tweet, Tweet, Tweet by the Ames Brothers.
When my sugar walks down the street, all the little birdies go tweet, tweet, tweet. And in the evening when the sun goes down, it's never dark when she's around. She's so affectionate, and I'll say this, that when she kisses me, I sure say kiss. When my sugar walks down the street, the little birdies go tweet, tweet, tweet. I know a thing or two, and I'm telling you, I got a wonderful gal. She's got the cutest smile, million-dollar smile, she's such a wonderful pal. I just feel so happy, 'cause I love her so. When she is by my side, I'm so filled with pride, I want the whole world to know. She's so affectionate, and I'll say this, the when she kisses me, I sure stay kiss. When my sugar walks down the street, the little birdies go, birdies go, all the little birdies go tweet.